Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of You're Wrong with me, David Harsanyi, and her, Molly Hemingway. So, Ma, now we're just having a discussion. I think we should, that it should bleed into our podcast. What do you think? I do not like spicy food, and you apparently are a big fan.
For context, I'm like wolfing down some food because I have a day full of meetings. And I put it's basically like a bowl of ramen that I got at Costco. It's really good ramen. Tonkatsu. Anyway, I poured a bunch of hot sauce in it because that's how I like my ramen. And now my eyes are all watering. And I'm wondering why I do this to myself. Like, I love the flavor, but it's hard for me to handle. And then I learned that David doesn't like his food spicy, which makes no sense to me at all. Spice is wonderful.
Spicy.
Okay.
If something's spicy enough to make your eyes water and you look like you're dying over there, then it's not flavor anymore. It's just torture, right? So I don't like participating in that sort of thing. If there's just like a slight little afterburn or something, I think that's okay. But when people just spice up their food to the extent that they don't even taste what's going on, I don't really understand it.
Okay. Well,
just somewhere where we differ. You're wrong, Molly. But item one, getting back to the serious topics here. President Joe Biden's at the UN today. I think he touched on a number of issues, but obviously he was going to be speaking on Putin and Russia. And from what I can tell, he said the usual things that he does. But facts on the ground have changed recently, if we're to believe media reports. And I think there's consensus that it is true that Putin has, and obviously Russians have not done that well. They've been pushed out of certain areas that they had initially invaded and conquered. Putin is calling up reservists, I believe. He's even sort of implied that he would use nuclear weapons. So what do you make of all this?
So it sounds like you've been reading the framing that American media have been putting on this. So the framing of the American media is, Putin's instituting a draft and mobilizing forces and threatening nukes. And this means that he's losing. So let's take a step back and think about all of this, which is he has had some setbacks recently in that he had, essentially the equivalent of like military police controlling certain regions, and Ukraine was able to get back some of the areas that Russia had seized as part of its invasion of Ukraine. So, setbacks. I think we've seen American media way overstate the significance of those and the significance of what it means for the coming conflict. And so related to that, then Putin responds by saying, okay, like if you want to do this, we'll institute a draft. And don't forget, we have 6,500 nukes. And American media say, this is evidence that he's failing. And I think probably a more adult way of interpreting it is this is evidence he's not willing to lose rather than evidence that he is losing. He's, up to this point had two things that he wasn't deploying. And you pray that the last one doesn't get deployed. But one of them is instituting a draft of this kind. And then the use of nukes. And he's saying he'll keep going. He'll keep doing this until he gets what he wants. It's a sobering thing. And it's something where very wise, serious people should be moving to de-escalate unless they think nuclear war is one of the things that they're willing to risk to defeat Putin. And maybe that is what they're willing to risk. And maybe that is where they see things going. But I think there should also probably be much more honest debate about whether that's what everybody wants. If everybody agrees that rather than forcing these two sides to the table and having them come up with an agreement that doesn't get into a major world war, that they're willing to risk the world war. And nobody seems to be doing that. President Biden is speaking at the UN as we're doing this, so we don't know what he's saying. But I pray he is being, strong and wise and not doing that thing that like senators do, which is posture without having solutions. And I worry that that's what he's been doing thus far.
Well, I guess I'd say some pushback here would be that a major power can lose a war, even though it has nuclear weapons. We, you know, Vietnam's a perfect example of that, though perhaps that's not the best example because Vietnam was backed by nuclear powers. But let's say even in Afghanistan, I mean, we can be pushed out of a place just so because we have nukes. It doesn't mean we're willing to use them. I think Putin, though, whatever, however, you know, nefarious you think he is or people think he is, and I certainly think he's a dictator, is a rational actor. I don't know that he would use nuclear weapons. I doubt it. Obviously, there's always the risk. But I think what this event also tells us is that that Russia is a second-rate power. They have nuclear weapons, but the idea that they are something that, you know, I've always, even when Mitt Romney said that Russia was our number one geopolitical foe, I think he was sort of wrong. Obviously, I think they are a foe, but they're not as powerful as people think. The idea that they were going to be marching into Poland and Europe, you know, if we didn't stop them at in Ukraine, I think is ridiculous. But I'm not a serious foreign policy expert or anything like that. I just think that, yeah.
On that point, Putin, I hope we all agree, not a great guy, a bad guy. I was reading a few different pieces in corporate media that were talking about how he's got internal unrest. And I was listening to a discussion between a couple of various neocon foreign policy types about how, you know, he's a bad guy. The U.S. would like to see him no longer there. And then sort of deep into the conversation or deep into the articles, it comes out that the opposition he faces internally is the furthest thing away from the type of opposition we wish he faced. Like, we probably wish the opposition was from people or movements that were going to bring more freedom, economic or otherwise, to Russia that would play on a global stage better. The legitimate opposition that he faces is from people who make him look like a squish. So we, you know, the problem that he's facing, the domestic pressure, is not that the war is unpopular because it's too harsh. It's that the war is unpopular because it's not harsh enough. And so if there were, for some reason, a regime change there that we help foment, it might be like most of the other regime changes that we help foment, and that we get a much, much worse option than the one that we have right now, however bad it is.
Yeah, absolutely. There seems to be a lot of criticism in Russia that Putin's pulling his punches actually in Ukraine rather than, you know, not being toughened up. So yeah. And obviously it's like with Iraq, you wanted to, the important thing there was what happens after. We were told that people there would, you know, embrace democracy and that we'd have this ally to the United States, but that obviously didn't happen. I don't think, you know, so it's something we need to think about with Russia as well, even though I don't think Putin will be toppled by any democratic movement or anything like that.
I think you're right when you note that the Russian military is not some behemoth that can't be dealt with, or, you know, that it is unstoppable. I also think it's important to kind of know that they are going to war. I mean, they're technically going to war against Ukraine. We don't have our military, too many of our military people, presumably on the ground, but they are being supplied by U.S. weapons, and they're being assisted with U.S. strategy and intelligence. And that's not nothing to go up against the most powerful military in the world. And you look at what I worry about is that the U.S. is very bad. The entire West is very bad at reading Putin's red lines. You know, he doesn't communicate the same way you might expect our politicians to. And you get these indications that you have not read the red line when he, you know, takes Georgia in 2008 while the U.S. is distracted in Iraq. Or he takes Crimea under Obama. You know, didn't take anything under the Trump administration, which is a really interesting data point. And then goes in for the Donbass as soon as he can with Biden. And now he's saying, I've got two things left. I've got mobilizing forces, which I haven't really done yet, and I've got nukes. And we're not listening. We're not reading this correctly. Again, maybe we don't care. And maybe we just say everything's worth defeating this man, no matter if it means that a worse person gets in or, you know, we have to expel them from Ukraine, even if it means nuclear war, or even if it plunges Europe into a depression that costs us all sorts of problems, or, you know, it just doesn't seem like we're, it seems like we're living in the land where we just know we're right. And by the way, we are in many ways on this. And so therefore it doesn't matter what tools he has at his disposal.
Yeah.
Oh, and also they just instituted referendums in some of the regions that they took. And those places are probably going to agree to be part of Russia, which all of a sudden means that if you go and, you know, get them back, you're going into Russian territory, or it could be viewed that way. I mean, it's getting messy.
Yeah. And I think that a lot of people here, because it's easy to sort of virtue signal with the Ukrainian flag and all that. I am not a huge fan of Ukraine. It is not a great democracy. It does not have a great history, especially, you know, on a personal level with Jews, for instance. So I'm not a huge fan of Ukraine in general, but also ethnic Russians have been moved there, have been living there forever. It is a very complicated situation, especially as you get closer to the Russian border. You know, these things are not going to be worked out through a proxy war by the United States. I mean, I just don't think Ukraine can go into Russian areas, take them, hold them. That's not a realistic goal. So I do worry about that. Obviously, I think morally Ukraine is right, and any nation should be able to defend its borders from aggression. And, you know, I'm a little torn on how much help we should be giving them, because as you've mentioned, I mean, it's going to lead to nuclear war. It's something that we should think about. Also think about the reprisals that could come next election or whatever. I mean, you know, if everyone thought that the Russians stole democracy with a few Facebook ads, imagine what's going to happen the next presidential election. So I worry about that sort of thing. So it's an incredibly complicated situation that people just throw, you know, there's a lot of sloganeering going on when we talk about it. And that annoys me and bothers me, even though in my heart, you know, I'm with Ukraine. I want Ukraine to stop Putin, and I wouldn't mind Putin falling, except, you know, who will take over? That's the question.
Right. And there are also the issues. The one thing that we really could have and should have done was work on increasing our energy supply. Like, that's a really smart way to push against Russia. And Biden stopped all of our energy supply. I mean, he crushed it because of his climate friends. And so we had that tool at our disposal that we're not using. And then the other thing that's of great concern is that the message from various Western leaders, U.S. has to keep running this war. And I say the U.S. because they say we have to keep supplying Ukraine, but we spend more than almost every other country combined. So what they're really saying is that we have to do this. And when they say that, that means that we're keeping our eye way off the ball with China. And there's so many things that could and should be done to make sure that China doesn't rise in power in a way that's detrimental to our national interest. You know, economic issues in play, military issues in play, alliance building in play. And this Russia-Ukraine thing affects us, you know, in an existential way, or it could affect us in an existential way. And we wish that we had the ability to push back against every bad actor in the world, but that doesn't mean that we do have that ability, and that we can go around not prioritizing what we need to do.
Also, it seems to me that European nations are far less zealous about this than we are. And Germans, for instance, who should be taking the lead on protecting Western Europe, even though obviously Ukraine's not Western Europe, but their interests. So yeah, it's a big giant mess. And we have the worst person leading the country into it, a president whose foreign policy instincts have been literally wrong 100% of the time. You have to try to be terrible, to be as wrong as Joe Biden has been on foreign policy throughout his career. But
that's a very common Republican talking point, and I'm not sure if it's entirely true.
Okay.
Meaning, anytime he opposed, say, nation building wars, they would say that was wrong.
Like where? Where did he oppose a nation building war? He was against the first Gulf War, I believe. He was for the second, you know, Iraq invasion, which was a nation building experiment.
Right. Granted. But when it came time to realize the folly of that, he was critiqued for wanting to leave.
Yeah. Well, he only wanted to leave after it support for it cratered in the United States in polling. It was never, he's constantly just following whatever, wherever the Democratic, the center of the Democratic Party goes. Just think he's spineless on foreign policy issues. But in any event, I think we should go to item two. So there's news that the New York Attorney General is filing charges, not against simply Donald Trump, but his entire family and executives of his company for inflating their worth, I think personal worth, in an effort to get loans from big banks. What's her name?
Letitia James, I think.
Yeah. She ran for a very short time. She ran for, I believe it was governor, basically on a platform that she would prosecute Donald Trump. This is a civil suit, so I believe that it's only fines, involved, no jail time if people are found guilty. But what do you make of this?
I think it's like just a horrific, un-American thing to do. When she ran for office, she said, if you vote for me, I'll figure out a crime that I can charge Trump with. She was unable to do that. So now she's got the civil suit going against Trump for something that just seems like extremely weak, or if it's not weak, could be prosecuted against like a million New Yorkers. And that we really have a problem with Democrats' attack on rule of law, all done, by the way, in the name of rule of law, which is particularly insulting. Biden himself has signaled that he wants Republicans in jail. He wants to put the Republican Party in jail. And they're doing all sorts of things to accomplish this, with the J6 committee, with the grand jury in D.C., with a grand jury in Fulton County, with this New York AG, with his speech where he kind of said it's OK to do whatever you need to do against Republicans. And by the way, someone presumably caught wind of this type of way of talking. And we just had a report of a man killing a teenager. And when he called it into 911 to admit that he had done this, he said that he was an extremist Republican, which is Biden rhetoric. In their pursuit of Republicans and trying to put them in jail, they're going against, Sixth Amendment right to fair legal representation. There's an all-out war to keep Republicans from having legal representation. This is a highly funded effort. It has a name, Project 65, where they're trying to disbar any effective Republican attorney. They, right after the 2020 election, they moved to get commitments from every major law firm that they would not represent Republicans in election disputes. You have attacks on freedom of speech. I mean, some of these grand jury actions against people hit directly at not just freedom of speech, but the speech and debate clause of the Constitution, trying to haul people in to disclose what kind of research they did before they voted as a senator, like has happened to Lindsey Graham. There are attacks on freedom of assembly. They are subpoenaing and weaponizing law enforcement to go against people who have held lawful political assemblies to redress grievances with their government. And they're tying them with people who've done unlawful rioting, which is not okay.
And how about citizens like the MyPillow guy whose phone they take, and for what reason we don't still know, right?
They're taking things without supplying the warrants, and they've done that for high level attorneys and low level just people. And it is chilling speech. It is a violation of speech. They have like had a history of going after communications, privileged communications between Republicans and their lawyers. I mean, this is like unprecedented what we've seen here. This goes back a couple of years, and then leaking those communications to friendly propagandists at the New York Times or Washington Post. I mean, this is horrifying. And I understand, people look at this and they go, okay, they figured out that the Republican Party has finally figured out how to have like an effective political coalition. Conservative populism is very powerful, very large, and can win elections. So we've got to stop that. And I understand the desire to stop your political opponent, but there should be some restraint here. And there's no restraint. I mean, they're literally trying to jail Republicans. It's
yeah,
Stalinist. It's Banana Republic. It's third world country. It's horrifying.
There is no restraint. It also muddies the waters of actual prosecutions that should be undertaken that matter, and ones that don't. No one trusts anyone anymore. But also, I think part of this, and we saw it with Biden's speech a couple of weeks ago, is that the dehumanization of your political opponents. It's just part of it. Every time I write about how I think, you know, constitutional rights to due process have been undermined, like on Twitter, elsewhere, I get 100 people telling me that these are fascists who want to undermine democracy.
Yeah, so anything is justified.
Okay. And that is essentially the excuse and justification for literally every authoritarian regime that's ever existed. Now, I'm not saying we're there yet, but, you know, like I try to avoid using the word Stalinist, even though I know what you mean, show trials and so forth. But I mean, the rationalizations are often quite the same if the outcomes are not the same yet, thankfully. But yeah, I mean, this is just something I just don't know where it goes. Like the other day, or quite often, actually, I think, what happens if Donald Trump wins the election in 2024? Like, where do we go from here? What kind of reaction would there be to that? And I just think the whole country falls apart at that point. I think governors won't listen to court rulings. I think you're going to have a bureaucracy that essentially, as they almost did or basically did against Trump, won his first term. It's a coup when you don't listen to the president and you do what you want. That's a coup. That's far more in line with the definition of a coup when the military is calling China because they don't like what the president's talking about, right? Like Milley did. I mean, these are actions. These are really seditious actions in many ways. So I can't find a word. You know, seditious obviously comes with a lot of baggage, but I'm just saying I don't know what a better word for that is.
You see all these people doing all these things, and I think it horrifies a lot of people in the country, but probably not, you know, probably the vast majority of people in the country are completely uninformed about what's going on. And then if they do have any information, it's filtered through a propaganda press. So there are a lot of people who are extremely worried about like the demise of the country, the demise of all these values that we are supposed to hold and constitutional principles. You know, it's a lot of people, but it's still probably like 30% of the country. It's an important subset, but I don't even know like how to operate in a system where only a smaller portion are truly informed about the threats to our system.
Like if the Trump Justice Department went after Michael Moore and with basically no real warrant went after his communications and decided that they could look at all his stuff because he said stuff that they say is, you know, undermines democracy or whatever, like they had with Mike Lindell, I would be pretty mad about that. I'd want to know why. I'm not saying I'm some highly principled guy. This would have just been the normal position of normal people forever in this country. This hasn't happened since Woodrow Wilson was putting people, anti-war protesters, in jail. So now, though, Mike Lindell has this, you know, is surrounded by the FBI in a parking lot as he's coming out of Hardee's or whatever. And not a single, I don't see a single principled liberal say, shouldn't there be a really good reason for this? He's a private citizen. He had some wacky opinions. That's not okay.
By the way, Matt Taibbi did a couple part series on all the violations of due process that are happening and all these like terrifying things as part of the campaign to jail Republicans. And he noted that the feedback he got from the left was not good. It was like, what happened to you, man? You used to care about civil liberties and now you care about civil liberties. What happened to you? And he was pointing out like, you know, obviously they're the ones who changed. He did worry about the civil liberties violations during the global war on terror. When the left was, you know, he thought being pretty principled in opposition to those things, but now they don't care at all. And, you know, they're even being more compliant with the security state than the right ever was. Like the right would poo-poo some of the problems with it, but they acknowledge that it would be a problem if you were violating civil liberties, whereas the left is just like, anything is justified to get the object of my hatred, which are Republicans.
Yeah. I mean, I'm an older guy, but every time I retweet like Glenn Greenwald, I'm like, I can't believe I'm doing this. You know what I mean? Like I used to hate that guy, but you know what?
He had the funniest tweet a couple of days ago where he said he's been dealing with some issues with his family illness and stuff. So he's kind of been offline a lot, but he said, I've been offline for 48 hours. So how are the migrants holding up in Martha's Vineyard? Have they all gotten homes? Are they all being supported by the locals? And it was just a joke about how, you know, of course, the locals in Martha's Vineyard could not handle literally 50 illegal immigrants for even 48 hours, which remains such an amazing story. I don't understand how they couldn't hold it together just to seem like they weren't monstrous people. Did you not enjoy that story as much as?
No, I loved it. I have to say, though, there's actually a link between the two things that we were just talking about now. And that is that on the left, on the progressive left that's taken over the Democratic Party, there is this, and this is a huge problem in the United States. I think it's sort of imbued in almost every issue we talk about, is that they want two different sets of rules for themselves and for their political opposition. And when you talk about immigration, the idea that 50 people could cause 50 migrants sent to Martha's Vineyard. Have you ever been there? I've been there. It is just
beautiful. I'm not gorgeous. I don't have your money and wealth and prestige.
I drove up there once when I was very young. But anyway, it is beautiful. And the idea that the same day as those 50 migrants, and by the way, you know, they're called migrants, and obviously I'm very sympathetic to what they want and their cause. But really, a lot of illegal immigrants just game the system now and demand amnesty when they get over the border. So, you know, so that we can't call them illegal anymore. But that's fine. The same day that happened, 1,000 migrants were dropped off in the middle of El Paso to fend for themselves. And there was literally one story in a Texas newspaper, and that was it. It is just mind blowing that they think this is an issue that they're winning, which they seem to think, you know. You know, all the columnists seem to think that this has backfired on DeSantis. I don't buy that at all. I think this is a winning issue. I hope they keep doing it. It, you know, a couple of states shouldn't bear the huge burden of millions, literally millions of people streaming over a border that is not secure. And Molly, I am like one of the most pro-immigrant people you will meet. My parents were immigrants. They were refugees. But we cannot have anarchy. This is just not a normal country. It does not work that way.
By the way, it really chaps my hide when people conflate immigration with illegal border crossings. I have many immigrants in my family. I love immigration. I think it's great. Like, I don't know, just love our country, and I like how we're united on a different approach to government. But we're also a country with borders, and rule of law is a really important thing that begins your citizenship here. And if you don't follow the laws, it's an attack on the country too. So it just bothers me when people conflate like their immigration story with illegal immigration, particularly, you know, certain forms of it. I noticed that there was this Democrat activist sheriff in Texas who did the same thing that we're talking about with Letitia James and Joe Biden and all these people. He said, like, I don't know if any law was broken or what law was broken, but I'm going to find it and I'm going to charge, you know, I'm going to go after DeSantis for doing this. That's not how the law works in this country. That's that is a Stalinist approach. You know, you show me the man, I'll show you the crime. And we need to make sure that we continue to not allow this criminalization of political opposition. I saw this person say that, or I saw some people say they really didn't like that people were saying that military people rounded up these illegal immigrants and trafficked them to the base that they're being held at because like the National Guard is good. And I was like, if you don't understand what people are doing, having fun with this language, you know, this is constantly how people talk about any attempt to deal with the massive crisis of having an open border. They'll say, no, they're trafficking in humans, or the military was rounding them up, or they're, you know, remember that story about the guys on horseback who were accused by Biden of whipping people, which wasn't true. It never was true. And yet they still were disciplined somehow for doing something that didn't happen. But on the other hand, it was really great that so many Americans figured out like right away what this story was about. I was traveling. Oh, I got to tell you a crazy story. I was traveling at the time that this story was breaking. And I was just listening to people on my airplanes and in the airport, and everyone was talking about it and chuckling about it. And I never hear a story break through that way. You know, people like us are weird and we talk about politics all the time, but this was just like in the general conversation. This does remind me that I sat next to Ehrlich Bachmann on a plane.
Tell me that. That's great. I mean, he's great in Silicon Valley.
So I didn't know much about him other than like, I think he beat someone up for being a Trump voter. He beat up his Uber driver once for being a Trump voter. And he once called in a bomb threat to, I thought it was a plane, but it was a train. So as soon as I realized he was sitting next to me, I was both very excited because I like him and I loved him in Silicon Valley, and the show just was nothing without him. But I was also scared because I was wearing a shirt that said like choose life on it. And I'm like, he's going to beat me up. But he didn't.
Did you sign a copy of Rigged and give it to him?
He was reading a Stephen Hawking book too, which was funny.
I wonder what he's up to now.
I know what he's up to. He was up to a comedy tour in Fort Wayne, which is how you end up on a puddle jumper next to Ehrlich Bachmann. TJ Miller.
TJ Miller, yeah. He was also in Deadpool, I think.
And Office Christmas Party, which is, you know, not the most moral film I've ever watched, but definitely.
That's a Jason Bateman movie, I believe.
Yes.
There you go. Okay. One quick, let's do one more political item if we could, because I like to mock Fetterman quite a bit in Pennsylvania. So I just wanted to say George Will, the, you know, old school conservative, right? A guy who's been around a long time. Why'd you make that face? So I don't know how to.
You're not supposed to out me for my faces. This is an audio only podcast. I am sad about what happened to George Will, but go on.
Okay. So he wrote a column essentially praising Dr. Oz for being basically an immigrant, for achieving a lot on his own, for being a self-made man, and dinged, I always forget Fetterman's first name. I want to say like Skip. Yeah. Let's call him Skip Fetterman. That's what he looks like. So Skip Fetterman says, you know, is constantly mocking him for his success, for his houses. For that. I think we spoke about this a couple of weeks ago where I only vote for people who are more successful than me. And I'm not sure John Fetterman actually meets that criteria. Maybe he does. I don't know.
Do your parents support your career right now? Because if not, right now, you're more successful than
there you go. Yeah. Though I don't know I could be elected for as governor of any town in America. But in any event. I was surprised to read that, and I feel like Dr. Oz has momentum going his way. Obviously, he's running against the guy who was insane before he had a stroke, and now he's incoherent, so he should be winning. But, you know, I just thought that was interesting.
I find it interesting. You know, I think I mentioned before that if I had been a voter in the Pennsylvania Senate primary, my candidate was like nowhere even near the top three contenders. So I'm not someone who completely understood the Oz approach, but I had later written a critique of Mitch McConnell's absolutely asinine trashing of his party's voters for the candidates that they picked in these various Senate primaries. And I thought it was, you know, I'm saying something that's obvious to everyone outside of DC, but very controversial within DC. You don't trash your party's voters for who they pick at the end of the game. Like, that's not the right time to do it. Mitch McConnell clearly lost on some of his picks that he wanted. He wanted more establishment figures who would do his bidding, and the Republican voters picked people who they did not view as fitting into that camp. But not being establishment is not a bad thing in this cycle. Like 75% of the country solidly, no matter like what the poll, so things like 70 to 80%, no matter what the poll, say they don't like the direction of the country. They are not looking for more DC in their DC solution matrix. So having a bunch of outsider candidates, whether it's like J.D. Vance or Blake Masters or Herschel Walker or Mehmet Oz, is not a bad thing in a year like this. And I said that and people were like, you think Mehmet Oz is, you know, not a clown? And I'm like, just on the heart surgery alone, he's clearly an accomplished figure. Right.
Yeah. I mean, he's done some things that I would say were clownish a little bit, but I overall, he's he's an impressive guy, and what his life has been impressive, and the things he's accomplished have been impressive. And, you know, my problem with him is that I'm not sure he believes the things that he's saying. And sometimes voters can sense that. I think he's gotten better lately when I see him in playing the role of a conservative. I think he's probably much more moderate than he leads on. I wanted to add to this conversation, and I think we also spoke about this a little bit last week, is that I keep hearing it is embedded in every single mainstream media or establishment media story that the Dobbs decision and abortion is killing Republicans. It's undermining their chances of winning the House, the Senate, presidency. They're going to pay for it forever. And it is literally not borne out in any evidence, not in polling evidence, other than when you ask them strictly about abortion, which is always a loaded question. But putting that aside, what race have Republicans lost ground on in the last, you know, month or two? I can't think of a single one. They've constantly been making up ground on a lot of these, in a lot of these Senate races. And there's a two point differentiation from then to now in the generic Republican House race polls. That could have to do with lowering gas prices. It doesn't necessarily have to do with Dobbs. This is just, and people fall for this, and I see conservatives saying it like it's a truth. It's not. It's simply not. And talked about this too, but Lindsey Graham's 15 week bill,
well, I will say,
not hurt a single Republican either.
Yeah, it should have helped them, giving them something to talk about and differentiate themselves from Democrats. I do wonder, though, if you're not realizing that there are states and districts where, you know, Planned Parenthood and various other abortion radicals and Democrats are making it impossible to even exist in a TV or internet space without a constant message on abortion. And that is included in races where the Democrat is going to do very well. I don't know. You know, I know that doesn't directly address this issue of whether it will cause losses, but, you know, you look at a race like Michigan, where Gretchen Whitmer, who's a really bad governor and who did a lot of really bad things during COVID, is up big. Now, probably she's up big because, like, the FBI didn't just help her by running that FedNapping plot. They also took out her primary opponent, I think, by charging him, you know, the Department of Justice charged him for attending the January 6th protest. There were shenanigans, sort of like weird shenanigans, that took out the next three top contenders. So, like, I don't think it's Dobbs that is giving Gretchen Whitmer the help so much as the FBI and other, you know, forces like that. But she's definitely running on an I like to dismember unborn babies kind of platform, and it doesn't seem to be hurting her.
Yeah, I think there's also a bunch of people out there in the world who are conservative, who are very happy that Dobbs happened, and who want more, you know, don't want the Supreme Court overturned, you know, and worry about the Senate and worry about things like that, and are for a national bill.
And
I think that most people who are single issue voters on abortion are not changing from party to party. And those are the people most animated by this kind of decision.
The other thing that people never remember is what a crisis it would have been for the pro-life movement, which exists in both parties, but primarily in the Republican Party because of how hostile Democrats have been to the cause of life. How devastating to that movement and its political power if Dobbs had not overturned Roe. Meaning, I actually think a bunch of people would have just checked out of the political process entirely, probably questioned the legitimacy of the Supreme Court. We would be at an even worse level of a situation in terms of, like, you know, civil.
No, it would have been disaster. After the fight, especially if Kavanaugh would have undermined it. I mean, after the fight, after everyone stood up for him, I realized that it's a principle.
Years, right. Yes. 50 years of supporting the institution and believing that if you really did get people on the court who cared about the Constitution, that justice would be done. And if it weren't done, then it would be like, well, we got to figure out something else because we've got this human rights crisis. And so people never remember the quiet and polite pro-life community, but they're powerful, and it would have been a big deal if they hadn't been able to do this.
I mean, the last, it would have been despair like there was at the end of the second Bush term, W. Bush term, where I felt like no one cared about, you know, Republicans had checked out. They didn't care anymore. They had kept losing battles. The president said he had to save the free market by destroying it or whatever. I mean, it was just like one disaster after the next.
Yeah.
Okay. Last item. This is a hugely important discussion we're about to have, in my belief. You were going to ask me about a piece I wrote just today about my favorite filmmaker.
Yeah, I did want you to write this piece. Your bravest stance, possibly, is your stalwart defense of Woody Allen. That is not a popular thing to say or do.
Not my bravest. My bravest stance is my defense of the designated hitter in baseball.
Oh, that's not brave at all.
You don't think so?
Wait, okay. You defend the designated hitter?
Yes, I'm happy that it was forced on everyone and
national. Oh,
so that's the most anger. That's
idiotic.
Fuel. Yeah.
That's cancelable. But you did a defense of Woody Allen, who has been canceled for a really complicated story. So why are you willing to go out there and defend Woody Allen so much?
Well, first of all, I just want to say that, the reason he was canceled was that his daughter, his wife in 1991, I believe, Mia Farrow, had accused him of molesting their adopted daughter. The New York, no one had found that accusation credible. So the New York Department of Social Services did not, the Connecticut police did not, the Yale New Haven Hospital sex abuse clinic did not. There were reports out and studies out and so on. So I defend him in the sense that he's accused of something that there is no credible evidence to support. I do not defend him in the sense that when you're 56 years old and you marry your 19-year-old, the stepdaughter of your girlfriend, long-term girlfriend, that is creepy. I will say that they've been married, I think, now over 20 years, and they have two adopted children. So it's, it is what it is. I defend him on that. And I defend him as being perhaps our greatest director, the greatest American director who's ever lived. He has created and made and directed and written more interesting quality films than any director. I'm not saying he's made the best film in any genre or the best film overall.
Do you think being a Jew from New York is coloring your view here at all?
100%. It is coloring my view. So I write that in the piece. I realize it's not for everyone. But simply because, let's say, I read a book about Christianity, right? I read something by Chesterton or whatever, and it's amazing. And just simply because it does not speak to me in the way that it speaks to a Christian does not mean that I cannot find value in it. And it does not mean that I cannot be impressed by the writing and the craft. And it does not mean that I cannot admit that it's a great work. Do you agree with that?
Absolutely. I agree with you on a lot of these things, including I enjoy several Woody Allen films. I have not watched as many as you have. I actually didn't watch the one that you said you'd watched 100 times in the
Love
piece.
And Death.
Yeah. So, or have I seen that? I don't think I have. I hate what happened to his family. You know, I think that was a very, that entire situation was just a horrible mess, like from the get go. And I understand divorce is extremely difficult. I agree with you on the lack of support. You did say no one finds her credible. And I do think some of her siblings have said that they believe her, even if they don't, personally have evidence to support it. Not that, who knows what all of that means. She also has siblings who don't, who are very close to the situation, meaning like they're on the day it supposedly happened, who say that they don't believe it. It's a horrible thing, and life is full of, lots of horrible things. And, we may never know all sorts of things about the family drama or trauma. But I think it's appropriate to receive and interpret art, not like in complete ignorance of who a person is, but with like a humility about what you can or can't know about who that person is, and also how their art might be separate from who they are as a person.
Yeah, I struggle with that sometimes. I mean, there are certain things a person can do that will make me just, it will make it impossible for me to enjoy the things that, the art that they make. So, and other times, enough time has passed by that, like, if Caravaggio's painting's beautiful, I don't care that he killed someone anymore. Like, enough time has elapsed. And then there's people like Raoul Dahl, for instance, who's an anti-Semite, whose work is just for kids is just wonderful. And it has none of that hatred in it. So I don't really care that much.
Yes, I think that's where it gets a little confounding. Like for me, if I'm watching a Woody Allen film and it's about, you know, a 19-year-old girl falling in love with a creepy old man or whatever, I'm like,
there's a lot of that. There's a lot of that. No doubt. So I get why it's distasteful for some people, but I just think that the man is a genius.
What's the angriest you've made someone by your defense of Woody Allen?
Well, today I've been being, people just call him a pedophile and call me a groomer and stuff like that. You know, like, okay, groomer, that whole shtick. I think I'm pretty even handed about it. And I concede that it's not for everyone. I concede that he's a creepy dude and his marriage was creepy, but I don't think creepy enough not to admire his work and love his work.
That's what your headline should have been: creepy, but not creepy enough for cancellation.
Well, I want to say, listen, I'm not the like funniest guy on earth and I write about politics, but I have to say, you know, he had a big influence on me when I was young. Like I loved his movies when I was like 7 and 8 already. And he just had a big influence, I think, about some of the cynicism I have or some of the, you know, the way I view the world in many ways. I mean, Bananas was my favorite movie as a kid. I love In Death. I love that. And Sleeper. And these movies, I just watch them over and over. And so, yeah. But I mean, that's what we're critics, right? And when we make our case, you know, for what we
do. And you appreciate people for the good that they've done. And that doesn't mean you have to support the bad that they've done.
Absolutely. Now, I don't know. Do you have anything that you've been watching? I know you've been really busy.
I have been traveling all over. I do want to say really quickly, and I know we have to go here. I was in Fort Wayne, as I mentioned, and there was this radio. First of all, Fort Wayne, I've always thought of as a not so great city. It's a small city in northeastern mm-hmm. Indiana. And this trip, it was so much fun, and it's gotten like oddly cool, which is weird. But they also had this radio station that I was listening to that kept on calling itself like progressive indie music or something. But then, you know how when there's a competing radio station on the same portion of the dial, it'll kind of like go back and forth.
Mm-hmm.
There was a competing station that was also good. So usually it's like a talk station competing with classical right. or something, but these were two indie rock stations competing with each other. It was very confusing to me. So I ended up looking it up, and one was out of Goshen, Indiana. The other one was run by a high school in Fort Wayne. And I'm telling you, it was the best station I have heard in so long. Like it wasn't just they had music I hadn't really heard before, like maybe artists I'd heard before, but different songs from them. But also that the what was playing one after another was so good. And it was entirely student run. I frankly don't believe it. I think there's got to be some like amazing teacher who's running the station who has excellent taste, or I want to meet the kids who are doing this.
Wow.
I think it was 91.1.
Do you remember any of the bands or anything like that?
I like Shazammed everything. Do you know where you do Shazam so that you can find out what a song is?
Oh no, I've never done that.
Oh, do you ever have that thing where you're like, I like this song?
Yeah. I've heard of it, but I've never done it. And you know what's funny? It's like, I don't remember the last time I listened to the radio. I never listen to the radio anymore.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I have a bunch of different ones here. False Hope by Laura Marling. A Lot's Gonna Change by Way is Blood. Gary Ashby, Dry Cleaning. Wildfires, Salt. Yeah, there was also just like Vampire Weekend of Montreal, Mitski.
All right.
The National. I don't know. It was good.
I found a great vinyl.
Oh, there was a song called Sunrise at Coalina. Yeah. And it was some like, and I looked it up and it was not even a real song. It was like some rando named Alex Tatiance doing, I mean, it was really good though. Sorry, go on.
No, I was just going to say to close shop that I have, I found a really great vinyl version of Modest Mouse, The Lonesome Crowded West, which is one of the, I'm not a huge fan of that band, but that album I think is one of the greats. And I got it for like $10. And it's an original.
Well, yeah.
I never get to say that.
Congratulations.
Thank you. And thanks everyone for listening again. The Lovers of Freedom and Anxious for the Prey.